From the shores of Puget Sound, this is Healthy Homecast. Healthy Homecast is created and operated by Healthy Painting and HealthyPainting.com. Healthy Homecast is your source for information, news, and events that focus on environmental responsibility, environmental consciousness, and eco-related products and practices. Find us on the web at www.healthyhomecast.com. And now your host, Daryl Whalen.
Okay, good evening, and welcome to Healthy Homecast, Episode 7. We're still trying to pipe in our cheering section there. The last episode, we had Casey Coulomb from ClearCore and American Lung Association's Master Home Environmentalist Program, and we should have that up soon. This evening, we have Nicole Starnes-Taylor, and according to her bio here, she's a AIA, a lead AP, principal from Make Design Studio, and we'll figure out what all that means. But before that, we're going to get right into it with Tony and the news. It's time for some healthy news, information, and events that are happening throughout the Puget Sound area, sponsored by PigeonPointPC.com.
All right, and welcome to the news, and welcome to spring, now that it has finally sprung out there. Anyways, few events for you today. First up is Seattle Tilts Edible Plant Sale. This is taking place Saturday and Sunday, May 7th and 8th, from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Buy organic veggie and herb plants that thrive in the Pacific Northwest climate, chosen by Seattle Tilts experts. Enjoy free gardening talks during the sale. Come afternoon or buy tickets to the early bird sales for $25 and shop first. This event is taking place at Meridian Park at 4649 Sunnyside Avenue North in Seattle. For more information, visit www.seattletilth.org. And next up, the May 2011 Green Drinks will be hosted on Tuesday, May 10th by the Green Depot, located at 4121 First Avenue South in Seattle. This event takes place from 5:30 p.m. to 9 p.m. Regulars know that EcoHouse has been the most excellent provider of the West Coast's largest selection of eco-friendly building supplies since 1992. They have recently joined forces with Green Depot to create a national presence. This is a great opportunity to see what is out there in the world of supplies for green living and building, while enjoying eco-friendly snacks and networking with like-minded people. As usual, they will be collecting a $5 suggested donation at the door that will be split between our featured nonprofit and Seattle Green Drinks. Also, make sure to help us reduce waste, even compostable waste, by bringing your own mugs, wine glasses, and the like. Compostable cups will be available for $5 suggested donation. For more information, email info@seattlegreendrinks.org. And last but not least, one of our prior guests, Rivoli Design, has a couple events coming up. First is May 14th. Ask a designer. Bring your backsplash and other tile dilemmas. They'll be holding a free session for tile design questions. This is taking place from 2 o'clock to 4 p.m. at the Art Tile Co. in Seattle. And the second event is May 21st on how to choose great color. They will be teaching a color and design class from 1:30 to 3 p.m. at the Finney Ridge Cabinet Company in Seattle. For more information, contact design@rivoli.com or call 206-465-4825. And now back to the podcast.
Please feel free to send any news, information, and events that focus on environmental consciousness and responsibility, as well as health, happiness, safety, and well-being, to info@healthyhomecast.com. And now, back to Healthy Homecast. Okay, we're back. So there's lots of good stuff coming up, and we'll put those pieces of information on our site. So once again, we have Nicole Starnes-Taylor from Make Design Studio. I met Nicole as an instructor for the Healthy Homes training. What was it? Healthy Homes for the Building Professional training that I just recently completed. Nicole is an architect and a green building consultant. She has experience with LEED, LEED for Homes, Living Building Challenge, and Net Zero Energy Projects. And we'll be finding out what all those things are. She's been a researcher on green building strategies and vernacular building methods, presenting lectures at conferences and universities. And when we took the class, that was something that was really, really a neat part of it. She had a very visual class. After graduate school, Nicole spent 2 years working as a carpenter, which was really cool. That was really a neat thing, and I want to talk to her about that. She received a Master's of Architecture from the University of Washington and a Bachelor of Environmental Design in Architecture from North Carolina State University. Both sides of the country, huh?
Yeah.
She's a registered architect and a LEED accredited professional. So, good evening, Nicole.
Thanks for having me.
You're quite welcome. So please tell us what you do, a bit about your company. Tell us what an AIA and the LEED AP principle is.
I could do that. So I'm an architect in Seattle, and I primarily do residential projects and some small commercial work. And AIA is just the Architects Professional Organization, American Institute of Architects. And LEED AP is sponsored through the U.S. Green Building Council. So it's an exam I took a few years ago to help support that program, which is the LEED program. If you look on the usgbc.org website, you can learn a lot more. They've got it split into a variety of different building types. And I would say it was one of the first tools developed that's had a tremendous impact in changing the green marketplace.
Yeah, I remember from your class, you threw out a lot of websites.
Yeah.
And a lot of books, too, I remember.
Yeah.
Actually, those can be found on the, healthypainting.blogspot.com site. So tell us, how long have you been doing this? How did you start the company?
So I've been an architect for 14 years, I think. And that, I guess, includes school as well. Make's been open for, I think, 2.5 years. And the company for me is really fun. I love what I do. I absolutely love design and architecture, and I love working with clients, which is a big part of residential work. You really get to know the people that you're working with. You learn about how they live and sort of what their dreams are, and they're very much attached to that that end product that you're working on. And that's very rewarding for me. And the green building side right now is really just worked into every project. I do some work where it's just me working as a green consultant. For the most part, though, it's in tandem with the practice of architecture, which is my preference. I think they always should be linked.
So how about the pre-make design? How did you cut your teeth?
Pre-make. I worked at several architecture firms, and mostly in residential work, some mostly smaller firms, and I guess there are one or two larger ones. Locally in Seattle, I worked for the Miller Hole Partnership and David Vandervoort Architects, and I worked as a carpenter for JAS Design Build.
Great. So how did you learn all this stuff? What was the inspiration for you getting involved in this in the first place?
I was always really interested in green. So I would say I was just raised that way. So it's really a credit to my parents, particularly my mom, who is very focused that way. We grew up in the burbs, but always had a garden when no one else did. And I grew up in Virginia Beach. So environment, we were probably a mile off the beach. And it was right on the Chesapeake Bay, so there's just a lot of education in that community on environmental issues. And then when I went for undergrad, I just was really interested in that. And the curriculum, to some degree, supported that. But that was, you know, early 90s, and I think it wasn't quite as strong then. And I just was really fortunate. Every firm I worked in, they always knew I was excited about green. So anytime a green project or opportunity came through, I was able to work on those projects and work with really talented people to help grow my knowledge. So it's been fun.
What about pre-college? Were you a builder? Were you like a tomboy or a tomgirl?
I was a tomboy. I think most of my childhood was building tree houses. I for years and years of tree houses. And I loved it. Yeah, I was really interested in sports and building. And yeah, but the carpentry wasn't till later. That wasn't till my 30s, actually.
Yeah, I'm from Ohio, so tree houses were a big deal. I just heard on the radio, I think, that tree houses may not be legal in Seattle.
Oh, no.
We'll have to look into that sometime. Well, we already know that you thoroughly enjoy the work. You stated that. Can you share any particular person or thing from your past that's been a big influence on your life? I mean, inside or outside of your career?
Oh, I think, again, back to how I was raised, I would certainly credit my parents. And I think growing up in Virginia Beach had a huge impact. Growing up that close to the ocean, I remember years and years of riding my bike to school and playing at the beach and planting dune grass and learning about the importance of dune grass and not to pick dune grass. You know, and that just being in that environment really fostered respect for the environment. And also as a kid, I was sort of, I played hard, but I wouldn't say I was sickly, but I would say I was sensitive. So things like new car smells and new furniture, you know, when people get excited, oh, that car smells so good, it would make me sick, even as a child. You know, I'm certainly not chemically sensitive to a degree where I have limitations, but I was certainly more aware. And I think that had a huge impact on my interest in it now.
Isn't it interesting that we look back and we equate good smells with actually being like poison? So, yeah, there's a lot of people that do design and architecture and stuff like that. How does what you do differ from other people in the field? What makes you special?
Oh, I think for me, I get excited. I always think about it as three parts. So I've had this amazing opportunity to work on a lot of very green projects. And then my architecture education in many ways has been pretty traditional in terms of education and practice. But then I think those two parts combine with experience in the field. So taking 2 years off after graduate school, I took 2 years and worked as a carpenter. And I always wanted to. I always wanted to build. I had no idea what I was doing. And I really think all architects should build. I mean, it is insane that architects in some ways are directing contractors through their drawings and yet may have no idea how to build and what the issues are, timelines and, you know, the complexities of coordinating this team, you know, mechanical people and plumbers and electricians and painters and who comes in when, and understanding sequencing was very useful for me as an architect. So I think those three, that sort of three-legged stool, has been very helpful for me.
Yeah, I think for myself, like some of my best clients are the ones that can actually likely do the work themselves if they weren't to mm-hmm. hire me.
Yeah.
And that really makes them a lot more open to what goes into it and gives them the space where they can really pick somebody that's, you know, great for the job as opposed to somebody that just might be okay for the job.
Oh, yeah.
Is there anything that you'd like your clients to know or to understand about what you do or your line of work that they may not be aware of already?
Oh, I think my dedication to green building, it varies on every project. And I try to share with clients things that don't add cost are just a part of the process, you know, and things that do add cost, I try to let them know what the options are and what that cost impact is. So I think just sort of being open to how we can integrate green building into good design.
So what methods do you use to communicate this message with your clients and your potential clients?
I use a questionnaire, which is just sounds like the worst thing ever. But it's really wonderful. The questionnaire is, we use that right at the very beginning. And it's broad in scope, meaning it's not just focused in green building, but it's really focused on how they live. And I think that's the key, is how do they live and how can good design improve their life? And I was recently at a project and it warmed my heart. My client said, "You have changed our life." It was just a kitchen remodel.
It's not just a kitchen remodel, though, is it?
Yeah, but it changed their life, and it made their family able to celebrate meals in a way that they hadn't before, and it just made me feel so excited. And part of the success of the project was the client's openness and really analyzing how they live and what they want, and then my job's easy because all those parameters are there. And so then it's just take all that information and create a design that supports that. And that's exciting.
Yeah, that's really great. Thank you. The thing about the Healthy Home Cast is, some people, now that we're starting this out, are getting the idea that it's just about green building and everything. And really, the true thing about health isn't really about that at all, in a sense, because it's about the community and the family that you're talking mm-hmm. about that you can create through your work, whatever your work is.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about the vernacular building thing? Is that the
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, we want to know a little bit about vernacular building. So, that's the thing about the thing that you did over the other countries and talked about the different buildings and stuff. So
yeah, so we talked about that in the class, and I always try to sneak it into any time I do a lecture or class because I just love it. So vernacular building is the building that people do without architects, right? And I shouldn't say without architects, but I'm thinking specifically of one of my favorite books on vernacular architecture called Architecture Without Architects by Bernard Radofsky, which I would highly recommend. But it's the way people build when they're really in tune with their environment and their culture. And their buildings perform without mechanical systems and electricity and air conditioning. And so they're meant for that climate. And there's a lot of wonderful information available. And for me, it's just a fun tool to use when I start a project or there's a specific issue that, let's say, the client brings to the table and says, "I'm really passionate about green building, but I'm most passionate about water. I want to do something amazing with water." Is I'll turn to vernacular building to sort of say, okay, well, how did other cultures solve these questions about water? What can I learn from them? And they're so inventive. You know, they're not using electricity and all these other things, so they're really creative. So for me, it's a wonderful tool that way, and it's beautiful. It's in its place.
Great. And how about a little bit of talk about you went over to these other countries and you were showing these slides and you were talking about how, and showed also in the pictures, how they integrated the new construction with the old construction and did it so beautifully. And I was just talking to Bill Daly actually today, and we were talking about this very thing about how these buildings over there are 400 or 500 years old, and what they do, what they seem to do from what you showed, how they really honor that old mm-hmm. architecture and stuff instead of putting something completely like different like next to it. Do you have a little bit of something you could say on all that?
Oh yeah, I guess I have two very different views about that. So one is, of course, to preserve the historic and to try to be respectful of that and building to a scale, right, that works with that. But what's also exciting, I think, is not to try to mimic that. So maybe you respond to this historic building with appropriate scale, but maybe you do have a more modern interpretation. So you're learning from that old building, but you build it in today's materials and labor skills, and it doesn't look the same. So if you were on the street, you would look at it and say, well, no, that's the building that's from 1450, and this is the new building for today. And they're different, but respond well to each other.
Yeah, they complement each other mm-hmm. and honor each other's purpose and look and everything. Cool. So a lot of people don't really know what the LEED Home things are, and you talked about being versed in that. Tell mm-hmm. us a little bit about that.
Well, for residential, there's LEED for Homes. And I worked on a project that was in when Lead for Homes was in its pilot phase. And it's really a checklist for the contractor. As an architect, I certainly took a back seat. I was a part of that. It was a pilot phase. I was certainly there to support, but it was really the contractor's responsibility. And it's really a checklist, sort of a guide of things that need to happen on the project to get to a certain level. And LEED has a variety of levels that you can reach in terms of certification. But it differs in some ways from Built Green in terms of being a little bit less specific. I think a program like LEED and Built Green are both have their strengths. And working on a green building project, I actually love to look at them all because they all have so many wonderful ideas and ways of looking at things. LEED's a little bit less specific. I would say it requires a lot of documentation. So for contractors who are interested, certainly read in advance. There's a fair amount of documentation and sort of information to collect. You know, things like a concrete pour, for example, if you specify a certain amount of fly ash, you need documentation for that, which is a good thing. You know, through that process, you're learning, right? You're learning what's in. You ask the right questions. Okay, we need fly ash and concrete. How do we do that? Let's get it. You're promoting that, right? Because now the concrete company needs to respond. So I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing, but it was a bit of work.
So when your clients come to you, your potential clients, do they know you as a designer or do they know you as a quote unquote green designer, or is there a certain percentage of each?
I think there's a percentage of each. A lot of clients come to me, they'll do a little research. The web's wonderful that way. So I'll meet them or they'll hear about me through someone else. And, you know, part of that conversation is usually, oh, we Googled you and we saw you're really into green. Can you elaborate on that? And so that's a wonderful way to sort of open that door in the conversation.
Great. So can you tell us about the Living Building Challenge was something else that you mentioned.
Living Building Challenge to me is right now, for me, probably the most exciting. It has 16 sort of levels. So if you start to look at green building guides, you can really get inundated with how thick they are. And there's this checklist, and it's a long checklist.
And how many there are.
I mean, it's really overwhelming. So when you start to look at those in contrast to Living Building Challenge, Living Building Challenge just has 16 little parts. They're big. I say little parts. It's water, right? Okay, we're going to reuse all the water on site. That's huge. Zero energy. You know, it's other programs say, oh, okay, with energy, we need to be this much more efficient. And we want you to seal the door and do a blower door test. And all of these are fantastic. And they're all useful. But Living Building Challenge, they're just not messing around anymore. They just say, we're just going for zero energy. And what I love about that program is they say, you have the freedom to figure it out. So I think it really encourages creative thinking. And not that the others don't, they're just a little more restrictive in that, you know, you're thinking, okay, how do I hit this one line item? Whereas Living Building Challenge really just says, figure it out. We're not going to give you many parameters. And to me, that's the most exciting because then people really push the envelope.
So what's the, so Living Building Challenge is a local thing, correct? Or
yes. Yeah. So that was started in the Northwest. And I believe the last I heard, the U.S. Green Building Council, so that's the larger organization, has adopted it. Is that, have you heard that as well, Doug? Yeah.
Doug probably knows a little bit about it.
I was going to say. Yeah. But so they've adopted it, which is really exciting. And it's, yeah, they're making huge strides. There's also the Ferros program, which is a materials-based program that developed out of that, which is
Does
a way.
Does Roger Ferris have anything to do with that?
I don't believe so.
Do you know Roger Ferris from Finney Center?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So the Ferros program.
Yeah. So it's Ferros. It's P-H.
Oh, okay. It's spelled different.
A-R-O-S, yeah.
Oh, Ferros. Okay.
Ferros
yeah,
program.
About that in the class.
Yeah. But that's an excellent tool that was developed through that program to analyze materials. because that's a huge issue, right? You can never get information on materials. And so this program allows people to plug in data that they have and is encouraging companies to release information so you can determine how green a product is. And specifically, I always feel strongly for people. There's no sort of right or wrong with green. People just feel passionate about different parts. And so that program helps people who are very passionate about social equity to say, okay, I really want to make sure I've got that covered. Or, I want to make sure that this really addresses water or indoor air quality. So it sort of breaks down some of the complexities of material research.
So what exactly is the challenge about the Living Building Challenge? Is it a competition between designers and builders, or?
I think it's the challenge of meeting that goal. And, you know, when it first came out, people were sort of like, oh, we can never do this. We can't do all of it. And that, you still see that today, right? You'll hear about a project say, oh, we're zero energy, but that's it. And it took everything they had to get there, right? You know, they thought about zero water, but they were too tired. I mean, it's just too much work. And so when Living Building Challenge came forward and said, okay, we want it all, you know, this is the challenge, figure it all out. That's huge. And they're very, I think they've done a great job of encouraging, okay, we realize everyone's not going to figure it all out today. So if your project is really strong in energy, let's see it. Let's see how you problem solved. And so they're accepting all the pieces people figure out along the way, which is helping.
So it incorporates the energy efficiency, but it also incorporates the health aspect,
yes,
which is a huge deal. Mm-hmm. We've been learning a lot about how, green isn't necessarily always healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
So the living building challenge, cool. And what about the net zero energy?
Well, net zero energy is exciting. And I think for most people, energy gets people the most motivated. And it's something tangible that you can track. And I would say for LEED projects, that's sort of been an issue, is that those projects were given a LEED certification, but then there was no requirement to come back later and check those buildings. So they found, oh, these LEED buildings aren't performing as well as we had hoped. And, you know, I think the obvious remedy is to require that we follow up after that building's been under construction and occupied in a year, come back and test it. So we learn, right? Because that's the huge part. And we keep learning. We come back in 5 years, we come back in 10 years, and we keep checking and tweaking to see how these buildings are performing.
Okay, yeah, that was that class that you were teaching, and they talked about that. I didn't realize that the net zero energy was associated with that. I mean, it was so incredibly overwhelming and so much information, but I guess I got a little bit of the gist out of it from that. So I've got a number of things here that you had specifically said that you wanted to communicate to our podcast listening audience out there in the world. So one of the things, with a tight budget, where are the best ways to spend your money on a home remodel to ensure a safe, healthy living environment and environmentally responsible choices?
Well, I think for me, a big part of that's indoor air quality. And again, we've talked about water or energy efficiency. I think indoor air quality for a long time has sort of been the last thing on the list of green building. And for me, it's one of the first. We spend 90% of our time inside, 90%. Mm. And then we hang out inside with products that off-gas and potentially make us sick. So with homeowners, I feel like if you're on a really tight budget and you want to make some changes to your home, be really careful about what you purchase and bring into your home. I mean, maybe even before you do what we would call construction level work, you know, and you, and I certainly have, poor IKEA is going to come after me one of these days, but I have IKEA furniture at my house and I am now really scared of it. I am scared of my IKEA bookcase. You know, being careful, things like particle board are really toxic. You know, if they're off-gassing formaldehyde, you know, or medium density fiberboard, unless it's formaldehyde free, these are products that can make you really sick for a very long time, like 30 years or more. You know, and I think most people think, oh, just let it air out. It has that new smell. Just let it outside and cut the plastic off and give it, you know, an hour or two. It'll be fine. But
air out for an hour.
Yeah, yeah. That's totally not the case. You know, it takes much longer than that. And, you know, it's sort of slowly making you ill. And things like carpeting, you know, really trying to eliminate particularly wall-to-wall carpeting, it's hard to clean, and it holds a lot of things that make us sick, as well as the carpet itself will off-gas.
For a long time. Yeah, not only do we spend 90% of our time inside, it's could be up to, like, what is it, up to 100 or 1,000 times more polluted than the outside as well?
Yeah. I mean, that's scary. And, you know, there's been a lot of press about, well, buildings are getting tighter. The more energy efficient we get, right, we correlate that to a tighter envelope, meaning less ventilation. And so making sure, you know, for one, we're getting enough ventilation. And a big part of that is just don't bring toxic things in your house, because our houses are tighter. I mean, you wouldn't want to anyway. But, you know, particularly now that we're in tighter homes, you're trapping yourself in there with these things that are rather toxic.
If it's not truly a healthy home, it could be energy efficient, but it could be extremely, extremely toxic.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's so I guess you were just kind of mentioning there about how indoor air quality is often overlooked. You were talking about the cabinetry and everything. The thing I think that's interesting about the IKEA thing that you say, and I've heard that before, is, isn't that company from a part of the country that's, like, generally pretty, like, open about environmental responsibility and stuff?
Yeah.
So it's kind of ironic that they're sending that out like that.
And it's inexpensive, and I think a lot of their things are really fun and to some degree well-designed. But it's, you know, working with clients, and they say, well, we really want this kitchen remodel, but we don't have a lot of money, and, you know, can we skimp on the cabinets? You know, can we do, you know, let's just say, for example, particle board instead of plywood? And I just say, don't do it. Don't do it. For one, they won't hold up. You know, that's another part of it, let alone the toxicity of the materials. But you're going to spend a lot of money. I mean, a kitchen remodel, that's a lot of money. And then you're going to put, you know, a particle board product that really won't last. You know, it's in a moist environment. You know, I've heard stories of drawer faces coming off the drawers, right? You know, things just, if you want to build, maybe build less, but be more thoughtful in terms of it being more durable and healthier. And, of course, it should always be beautiful.
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of, like, old stuff. Like, you can go to, like, places like Second Use and stuff and get some amazing old cabinets and stuff that are, you know, pre a lot of this health type stuff, and get some pretty neat stuff. Do you do that kind of stuff where you incorporate, you know, older cabinetry and stuff from places like Second Use and stuff, and then incorporate that into, like, new building?
I'd love to, but I don't. So cabinets, I haven't been able to. It's been primarily a cost issue and sort of coordination issue. So I've been more successful with even doors, which is expensive.
Yeah.
But being able to rehang old doors, reusing flooring, you know, Restore is fun with their bowling alley material or bleachers. I've used those before, the old bleacher seats.
Yeah.
Cabinets are tough. And it really, we've got a new baby at our house, which is exciting, which has also made us so much more aware. We just bought a crib. How easy, right? Just go buy a crib. You know, in my mind, my husband and I looked at it, it's got to be solid wood.
Yeah.
Right? It's every part of it has to be solid wood, because this baby, you know, we don't want anything off gassing, but this baby definitely, you know, his little body can't handle it. So it's amazing when you start making decisions. You know, our household's always been certainly knowledgeable and careful in that way, but much more so now.
Yeah, and we know at that age, that's when their systems and stuff are the most susceptible to.
Yeah. So things like old furniture.
Crazy stuff that they put in there, yeah.
Yeah. But like the Second Use, you know, we're looking for a dresser. And we're looking at Second Use stores because we just want solid wood.
Yeah.
Just simple solid wood with no lead paint. I don't know if we'll find it.
I think you will. So, yeah, but that's – so you are doing it, though. It's just not as much with the cabinets, but with the flooring and stuff like that. That's really neat.
Oh, yeah.
So what about appliances and plug loads?
Oh, yeah, appliances. So I get excited. I love refrigerators. So at my house, we've got an itty-bitty. So there's three of us. We've got a 24-inch by 24-inch Vestfrost. I'm always pitching Vestfrost. I love that refrigerator. It's the most brilliant refrigerator in the world. It's very well designed. and it replaced our ancient almond-colored energy hog that up and died one day. And, you know, that old fridge was like 30 inches deep and probably 30 inches wide and...
About a ton.
About, yeah. Oh, and just... You know, that there was so much room in there. We could put food in there and let it go bad, right? Because you can't throw food away. That's wrong, right? Mom taught us, don't throw your food away. So we wouldn't throw it away. We'd wait until it was so disgusting that you didn't feel bad about it. And we did that by leaving it in the back of the fridge till it died. So now I think it's one of those things that has shaped how we live, which, you know, that's always exciting. Good design impacts how we live. So this little refrigerator makes us buy food more often, which means we eat fresher food, particularly produce, vegetables, because we don't have enough room to store them. And that's a really positive thing for us. So I get excited about refrigerators and encourage people to get newer ones and try to get as small as you can. You know, I work with clients and usually they go shopping and, you know, we'll discuss some parameters and the space we've got, and the 9 times out of 10, they come back and go, I need this really big fridge. It's got to be at least 36 inches wide. And, you know, it's got all these bells and whistles and an ice dispenser. And and that's great. You know, but I would sort of caution, well, you know, how much food do you need to store? Particularly, you know, if it's two people. You know, a lot of times it's 2-3 people. You know, I do not typically work with households with 8 to 10 people, I'd have to say. So really sort of thinking about that, because the refrigerator uses the most energy. So trying to keep your energy use down, particularly on the things that run all the time, like a fridge. So just trying to be really sensitive to adapting your lifestyle and just try it and see if it works. In our household, it's been fantastic. And then things like dishwashers, right? Looking for ones that are really good about water and energy use. Same with the washer and dryer. You know, with dryer, it's always fun to talk about a clothesline. My mom to this day has never had a dryer and never will. And she just believes in hanging clothes out. But of course, she's in the South and we here in Seattle with all of our rainy days, a dryer is awfully nice. So, you know, but I didn't think about this or realize it till later that part of a dryer's efficiency is how efficient your washer is, right? So get a washer with a really high spin cycle, because that spin cycle will help get more water out so the dryer doesn't have to do so much work. So just thinking about things like that.
So what exactly is a plug load? Does that have something to do with how long something runs? Or?
Yeah, so the plug load. So I think it's exciting now to think about how you can turn your house off. So there's tools starting to come out, right? So you have your TV plugged in. So it's really being cognizant of all those things that are running all the time. So you have your TV plugged in, but it's turned off, right? But it's not turned off, because you can take your remote control and walk up to it and turn it on. It's waiting for you. And while it's waiting, it's using energy. So what can we do? Can we put the TV on a switch so we turn it off, right? So we don't have to go behind it and unplug it, because, you know, that's not maybe the easiest thing to do, but why don't you hook that outlet up to a switch and just turn it off, or put it on just a little strip that you can turn off. You know, all these things that run with clocks, we've heard that before. Microwave has a clock, oven has a clock, everything has a clock. Turn it off, turn them all off. So try to get all of those loads down. You know, even plugging in a cell phone, people plug it in, leave it running all night. Well, the cell phone charges fairly quickly, and then it's still drawing energy, right, as it's sitting there sort of buzzing away. So trying to eliminate, you know, whether it's called phantom loads, plug loads, pull all of that load when it's not actually in use, try to drop that number to save energy.
Oh, yeah, you were talking about that at the class, about the phantom load chart.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I've got everything on strips right here, and I turn the power strips off, even on my oven and everything.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I got the thumbs up from the producer here, Tony, telling us that we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
You are listening to Healthy Homecast.
Gravity connects me to the earth, which connects me to people who connect me to myself more honestly. And gravity connects me to the crust, which connects to the leaves on the trees that make it possible to breathe.
with naive mind shield like a helmet. They would tell us that we don't know how we feel or how to connect with other people on the planet. Oh, if we only knew the power in each blue, disillusioned little.
We're back. And we're here at, let's see, episode 7 of Healthy Homecast. We're here with Nicole Starnes Taylor from Make Design Studio. And we're going to pick up where we left off. Building for future deconstruction. What the heck does that mean?
What in the world? Well, I just get really excited. You know, as an architect, you there's a lot of things that we don't control, right? I mean, that happen in the field or just the way we build. But I think architects have a great responsibility to really think about the materials they specify. That's a big part of what we do and what goes into the drawings. And I'm really intrigued with using materials that in hopefully not 20 years, hopefully 100 years or 200 years, when we take a house down, that we just can take it apart. And we don't, you know, we can, at a minimum, grind that material up and put it back to the earth, right? And it's not toxic. When we start to combine materials, so create composite materials, it's harder to recycle them and to split them apart. One example I'll give is, it's really exciting to hear about insulated concrete forms, but I'm hesitant to specify those, particularly ones that look like sort of concrete blocks. In other words, it's not a SIPS panel, but it's more of a concrete block looking form, because at the end of that building's life, how are you going to separate the styrofoam, which right now is most likely thrown away, from the concrete? It's just not going to happen, right? So then it by default becomes a landfill material. On projects I work on, I try to specify solid sawn lumber or glue lams. So glue lams use, right, more dimensional lumber with adhesives in between. And I try to specify those over things like TJIs or LVLs or PSLs, in part because it's just less glue. I like the idea that when we take apart a house later, so I have an old 1909 house that we take apart in pieces, unfortunately, on a regular basis. Some of it's still pretty exposed, but we're working with dimensional lumber. So, you know, and we're not dealing with the toxicity. You know, in our house, we're dealing with old growth fir, and we've added new lumber, which has just been solid sawn lumber, versus TJIs that off-gas, right? That web material in the TJI off-gases because it's an OSB type, you know, with lots of glues. So I try to avoid those. And then also, again, at the end of its life, what do you do with a piece of wood full of glue? I mean, at a real basic level, we can't really return that to the earth. And I don't know of a way, and if it may be happening and I don't know about it, but how we take that material and grind it up and make another wood product, right? Those are our two options. You either make something else out of it or allow it to return safely to the earth. And so I'm very interested in using products that do that. Moving forward. Yeah.
Yeah. Or what they do is in the middle of the night, they ship it off to like a third world country and like dump it in their like soil and stuff as if like another country isn't connected to our country.
Yeah. That we're all not one little planet.
What about windows? Vinyl, fiberglass, wood?
So I feel really passionate about no vinyl windows. So we're getting ready to set up a little nursery for our baby. And we've got this old 1909 house, and the people before us put in vinyl windows just in two rooms. The rest, it's all the old wood windows. And I'm sure they're more energy efficient than those old drafty windows. But I look at that vinyl, and I just see sickness. I just see toxicity. And vinyl, you know, as a window product, so a lot of times with green building, what you find is not only is it toxic, but it's not performing well, particularly the ones that are really inexpensive. So with windows, the expansion coefficient between glass and vinyl is the highest. So that's the worst you can buy is a vinyl window because they expand at such different rates, you're going to have issues with the seals breaking, let alone the fact that we know vinyl is toxic and not something we want inside the house. So a fiberglass window is even better, or a wood or a metal clad wood. These are healthier options and I think more durable than a vinyl window long term.
What about site drainage?
Oh my gosh, get that water away from the house, particularly in Seattle. That's really important. It's important at a real base level, right, for healthy building, for safe building. So we've had some structural failure at our house, so we're very sensitive about about getting water away from the house. But also just from a health standpoint, you know, you don't want mold. You don't want water collecting in one corner and then mold is growing and it's healthy and then that's coming into your indoor space. You know, this, it just solves a lot of things if you can just shed the water away from the house. Give yourself some overhangs, and if you're not, have a really good strategy to move that water away.
Mm. Yeah, we'll be having Dan Morris in the future episode, and he talked a lot about that in class, and he knows a lot about that mold and stuff mm-hmm. like that. Plumbing aerators and water use.
Oh, so clients will ask me, do you have a favorite faucet or do you have a favorite toilet? And from a design standpoint, certainly, you know, they're, that part's almost sort of easy. But another thing to look at that I think rarely comes up is looking at the aerators on faucets. You know, our water use is very much set by just how much flow comes out. And, you know, shower heads for years, I know the city of Seattle has encouraged that by giving away free shower heads, which we have at our house, which works great. It's a really successful low flow shower head. We're not missing. It still provides plenty of pressure, but it's reducing our water use. And so I think people are, they know about that, but they might not realize that on their sinks as well, to really check those aerators and try to get one that uses less flow. It's huge water savings.
Mm. When I was 18 years old, it was 1979, and I went from Ohio to California. I was in the Conservation Corps, and I'd heard about water conservation for the first time in my life. I was like, what the heck is that? And I've been really, really careful about the showering thing ever since then. Mm-hmm. That's been 30 years for me now.
Wow.
So let's see. So I was going to say that we're in such a disposable and a very visual, like, society and stuff. So sometimes we kind of, like, consider that stuff more than we do the actual functionality of things, mm-hmm. I think is what you were saying a little bit about mm-hmm. some of that stuff.
Yeah.
But they've done a lot of great stuff about combining all that stuff together.
Yeah. Well, I would say even 10 years ago, it was either or. It was either green and ugly, right?
Yeah.
Or it was, you know, not green in any way, but really beautiful. And you sort of had to pick which side you're going to be on. And for me, that was always horrible. You know, I always wanted it to be both, and I didn't understand why it couldn't be. And I think now we have products that meet both criteria very successfully. So it's much easier. Cost is still an issue. Green products, I think, while they're much more aesthetically pleasing, there's still, for a lot of things, is a cost increase.
Not necessarily everything, but probably a larger percentage.
Yeah, it's a slight increase. But, you know, you also weigh that over the life of the product. You know, something like a toilet that's beautiful, that let's say is a dual flush, that performs well, you know, you look at how much water you save, and it's a little bit easier to make that decision to pay more money up front.
Yeah, no, as far as paint, they had like a quote-unquote green paint like 20 years ago, but it was four times the amount of money, and it was like horrible.
Oh.
It was just a horrible product. So I know that's one thing that's come along pretty well, and the price mm-hmm. has actually gotten extremely like competitive with just about any other paint out there.
Yeah, paint's a great example, and I think it's a great example of most clients know about that. You know, to say a no VOC, they know what that means, and they want it, and they know it's not a cost increase. So that's been very successful.
So what do you see the average client as their interest, what they're interested in, and their interest levels in the trends in green building?
Most of my clients are very, they're excited about energy efficiency and sort of a basic, you know, maybe not over the top, but let's build a good building that's well insulated. You know, we talk about sealants and caulk, and sort of there's a balancing act, right? There's a toxicity that comes with some of those products. Sealants and adhesives are some of the worst for off-gassing. So sort of creating a tighter envelope, but making sure we're using safe materials. But I would say my clients are knowledgeable and positive about energy efficiency, but they are passionate about water. Nine times out of ten, they are excited about water. And in part, I'm sure that's because of our Northwest climate. But they're also really excited about what we can do. And so I've got several clients interested in green roofs, understanding the water impact of that. As a tool to clean the water and also sort of store the water on the roof until it hits saturation during our winters. And then the idea that this is helping to clean it and slow down runoff. Cisterns, I would say almost every single project, my clients are interested in using cisterns and in rain gardens, which is really exciting. But the implementation has been really difficult, and they're also excited about gray water systems. And I know the city of Seattle has tools in place that you can use gray water systems, but it's the hurdle of the financial impact. You know, you're basically doubling your plumbing. And so that, unfortunately, you know, in the beginning we're all excited, and then as we run the budget numbers, that usually gets cut out. But I know the city has been really great about offering classes. I'll be taking one next week on rain gardens and cisterns. And I think the public is there. If it could be more affordable, and if it could be a little more do-it-yourself, you know, right now it's sort of you need this giant cistern and a backhoe, and how are you going to plumb it? And things sort of get big, and then they get cut out. But as people learn more, and products are more accessible, I think that's going to take off.
Well, eventually, the way water is on this planet, we're not going to have much of a choice.
Yeah.
It's going to be, you know, people are going to be tripling up their plumbing and stuff like that if need be.
That's right.
How about insulation?
Oh, insulation, I think people are excited about. It's sort of easy. You know, I work on a lot of old homes. You know, like I said, mine's a 1909, and I work on a lot sort of that age all the way up into new construction. And insulation, just being really careful that what you install is not toxic. So, you know, cellulose insulation that's a borate-based, I think it's helpful. There's new, you know, fiberglass insulation that's no formaldehyde added, which is helpful. And, again, just being sensitive to things that off-gas. And there's, I know in the class we talked about spray foam insulation, and I always give spray foam such a hard time. But, you know, studies have come back and said something is shrinking. You know, spray foam, I would say maybe 5 years ago, was really exciting because, it would really insulate and you would fill this cavity and it would just stay that way. And then they came back later and tested, which of course is so valuable, right, that after installation testing, and said, okay, something is shrinking. It's either the insulation or it's the wood. Now, of course, it could be the wood, and that makes total sense, right? So now you have this air cavity, and so because this foam is sort of this block, right, it's not malleable, it's not shifting really, then you have this this road for the air to change. So this, you know, air infiltration issue between the insulation and the edge of that wood, well, now the R value is pretty horrific. So being thoughtful about using insulation that can adjust. You know, people worry about cellulose because it might settle. And I, you know, there's some debate. Some people say, you open the wall and it's not settling, it's doing fine. But what intrigues me is the idea that, let alone the fact that we're in an earthquake zone, but our houses move and shift and sort of give, and that we need insulation that can move with the house. And it's not this sort of rigid thing that once we have a slight shift, now we have very high air infiltration rates.
What is it? Six sides? Isn't that the insulation mm-hmm. rule?
Yeah.
Let's see. PV and solar and thermal.
Oh, yeah. So clients as well are really excited about photovoltaics. So, you know, energy from the sun as well as solar thermal. So heating hot water in order to preheat for heating systems and for domestic hot water. And again, those, you know, as the projects go forward, on all the projects I work on, we pre-wire and pre-plumb for those. So if they want to do it in 10 years, everything's there and they don't have to, you know, cut into the drywall. The tax credits right now are really good for that, but of course it's still really expensive. And, you know, everybody I know has a tight budget. I don't know anyone that says, I've got a ton of money, let's do everything on our wish list. And so, you know, a lot of times that is on hold for later, but I would say the interest there is really strong, which is exciting. And people are there hasn't been a single exception where people said, yes, please pre-wire for PV. Set me up for the future for that. They're certainly excited about it.
Yeah, you know, this whole economy thing is a real interesting thing. That's probably for a different podcast. But, you know, one of the positive things I see is that people are being a lot more responsible about their decisions and stuff about this kind of stuff. Now, I moved from Ohio about 9 years ago when there was, like, this boom going on. And people were ripping all these, like, I mean, they were just ripping the insides and the outsides of their house and, like, throwing them all in the garbage and everything and, you know. So I think that, in a sense, one of the positive things is people are being a lot more responsible and mindful about the decisions that they make with their houses and stuff. Does that seem to be a true statement to you? Or?
Yeah, I agree. I think people are much more thoughtful and they're more knowledgeable about materials. You know, it's, again, like you said, re-siding a house. You know, well, what are you going to use? You know, the goal is not to just keep sort of peeling off the toxic material. Because that happens, right? Oh, I've got vinyl siding. Oh, this is bad. I have to take this off. Or I have these vinyl windows, you know, like at my house. What are we going to do with this vinyl window? Hopefully what we're replacing it, we're just so much more knowledgeable that what we replace these products with is something that's going to last if we do have to replace them.
So what descriptive words, you know, we use this, we've been throwing around the word green a lot here. And when I put together so I changed my name of my painting company to Healthy Painting about 4 years ago. And I was really kind of tossed about the name. And I wanted to make sure that I didn't use the word green and the word eco and stuff. Not that I don't think they're great words, but I think that there's, you know, there's a lot of misuse and stuff about it. And so what particular language do you like to use around this stuff and, you know, and with people like that are in your
I totally agree
circles
with you.
And with your clients and stuff?
I think healthy is the strongest and the most lasting, because at the end of the day, it's healthy for us. It's healthy for the environment. You know, we talked about in the class the idea of, oh, don't worry about that toxic smell. It will go away, right? It'll go away. Well, away, you know, just because it's
away up into the ozone and like,
yeah, you know, there's no away. We've heard that before. There's no away anymore. So once you realize, you know, it's just because you take it to the landfill and it's not on your property anymore, or just because it off gases and leaves your immediate vicinity, that doesn't make it okay. So the idea of, yeah, I love that you named your company Healthy Painting, because I think that's the goal, healthy for us and healthy for the environment.
So what does a healthy home mean to you?
A healthy home is one that you feel good in. You know, as we already said, you're in it 90% of the time as you're inside. So in your house, one that helps you live the way you want to live. You know, that to me is fascinating. We all have different goals. Some people love to entertain a ton and they want people in their house all the time. And other people are a little more solitary. And, you know, reading or quiet time is what's magical to them. So I think identifying how you want to live and how you want your home environment to be so that it makes you happy. And you should feel healthy. You should feel good in your home. Because it's well designed and facilitates the way you want to live, but also because the materials are healthy and that you don't have chemical sensitivity issues because of things that you've brought into it.
So we're getting kind of close to the end here. I've got a number of questions. I don't usually ask these people, but I know that you're a good person for this. So when might something not appear to be green on the surface, yet actually provide a responsible purpose?
Ooh. Can you give me an example?
Sure, I'll give you an example. There's a company in Oregon, and what they do is they take paint and they put it all together and they mix it all together and they put some things in there and then they redistribute it. They don't give you a whole lot of choices with colors and stuff.
Yeah.
Now, it's not green paint, but at the same time,
yeah,
it's preventing potentially thousands or tens of thousands of gallons of paint from
recycling. Well, I'm certainly in support of that. I cannot think of another example now, but I'm sure there is one.
Well, that's perfectly fine. What about, okay, well, I'll just move on. I had another one that was similar to that, but I won't throw that at you. We're getting kind of close to the end here. What advice do you have for someone who is seeking the type of services that you provide, be it somebody here in Seattle or anywhere across the planet that people might be listening to this?
Well, when I interview for projects, one of the things I share with clients is, I talked about that questionnaire earlier, and particularly if there's another, if it's a couple, I recommend that they fill them out separately and then do one together. Mm. So really, particularly when there's two people or more involved, is really getting on the same page. So my goal is, I work in all sorts of different architectural styles, and it's and I appreciate all of them. So for me, the goal is really to get into my client's head and really understand what they want and what their goals are. So the quickest way I can get there, the better. So collecting images, I think people hear that often, and I will confirm it is incredibly helpful. To collect images and say, this is what I am interested in. You know, I like this little detail. The rest of it I don't like, or I like this color. That's really helpful. And then really getting your thoughts together about what you want. And that can include the dream list, and maybe the dream list won't happen. But knowing sort of what your goals are, I can help get you there through design.
I'm writing down a question to ask you like after the after the show's over here. So what helpful hints or wise advice do you have to share with people that has significant meaning to you?
Oh, I think, of course, this is probably not good for the building industry.
It doesn't have to be.
But be really cautious. I've always believed this, and my husband's been fantastic about this, is be really thoughtful about every time you buy something, every time you spend a dollar. You are making a decision that you're supporting that product. So I'm holding coffee in my hand right now, and I'm saying to that coffee shop, please stay there. Please keep selling coffee because I really needed that coffee, and I want you to exist. And really, you know, every time you buy a piece of furniture, you are very directly impacting what is available. And you are saying, yes, I like this. And that sounds silly, but it has a huge impact. And so we're pretty cautious in our house about purchases. And, you know, I certainly wouldn't say all of our purchases are green, far from it. But we are sort of careful about what we buy. And I would say with clients, it's the same thing. You know, looking at, for the building industry, a lot of times bigger is better, right? Bigger project, bigger fee, everybody makes more money. But I would caution, try to get away with less. You know, how big do you need that kitchen? If it's well designed, you can go a lot smaller. Or the house in general, be thoughtful about the spaces. So I guess I would err on the more sort of conservative side.
So what groups or organizations do you support or are you affiliated with?
Oh, I'm a huge fan of Northwest Eco Building Guild. So that's a local Seattle-based, Northwest-based organization, and I've been a part of that for many years. And by a part of it, I mean really enjoying. They do monthly lectures that, for me, have been unbelievably informative. Mm. I've learned a tremendous amount there, and there's a tremendous network of people and resources that have just been fantastic for green building. And I would say a lot of my local green building knowledge has come from that organization. Another one is CORA, Congress of Residential Architects, specifically maybe more helpful for architects and builders, but it's a wonderful organization for small firms. So I'm a small firm, And, you know, as a small firm, sometimes you can get isolated. You know, you're not in a huge office where you can send out an email and ask a question, right? And someone will know. A lot of the people that are a part of that are smaller firms, and people, you know, email out questions. You know, I need a roofing detail, or does anyone have advice on this waterproofing issue? And the knowledge in this community is unbelievable. And people are so open and willing to share. I've been so impressed with that, and it's been very helpful. I've certainly submitted questions and had really valuable information shared. So those two come to mind immediately as being really helpful.
Cool. Yeah, I'm not sure about Cora, but the Eco Building Guild is definitely going to be on the show.
Yeah, they're fantastic.
We've got them lined up already. Let's talk contact and social media type stuff. Website, phone number, Facebook, Twitter, blog. What do you want people to check out, and how do people contact you?
Oh, my web presence is really bad, so I would say website's probably best. So I've been slow to use other social media, but the website. Can I give the website address?
Yeah, you sure can, okay. And we'll also put it on the.
Oh, great.
On your episode, sure.
So it's just the full company name, which is makedesignstudiollc.com. And there's all the contact information is on there as well. It's probably the best way to reach me.
So any specials or upcoming events or information to offer our listeners that we can post or on our site or offer to our listeners?
Oh, I would say for me, I always encourage clients, particularly prospective clients, to call. So I do a free initial meeting, and it's pretty extensive. It's usually 2 hours long, and we walk through the house, and it's certainly an opportunity for me to share what I do. But we do talk about design during that meeting and green building issues. I feel strongly that first meeting, it's good to have that sort of conversation because it gives my potential clients a feel for how I think and work, and it's a good way to see if we'd be a good fit. So for people interested in green building or any sort of architecture project, certainly give me a call, and I'd be happy to meet with them.
Great. Well, that's we've got one last question, and it's been great. Episode 7 here of Healthy Homecast with Nicole Starnes-Taylor of Make Design Studio, LLC. And our last question, any last words or anything you feel was left out?
Oh, I would just say for the architects out there, get in the field. I think for me, one of the most rewarding and fun things I did was working as a carpenter for a variety of reasons. And I think that's important. I think that connection, design being connected to actually the act of building. And so, of course, you see that reflected in my company name of Make, but really staying connected between the act of making with your hands is very important. There's something that happens in your brain that's important when you have a tangible relationship to materials. And I think that's important to maintain.
Mm. Well, thank you so much. It's been great. On behalf of Tony Freiss, Daryl Whalen, and Nicole Starnes-Taylor, this has been Healthy Homecast. See you next time.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to Healthy Homecast, brought to you by HealthyPainting.com. Please feel free to contact us with any comments, questions, or suggestions for upcoming show topics or guests. Call us at 206-650-4587 or send a direct email to info@healthyhomecast.com. Be sure to check back. New episodes coming soon. By my side.
desert low, smells like bay.